Good evening. Thank you for coming out this evening. I'm delighted to welcome Vasilios Skouris, who's a law professor at Aristotle University, Aristotle University of Thessaloniki, and a former president of the European Court of Justice. He served in that role between 2003 and 2015. And Professor Skouris's talk this evening focuses on a difference between common law and civil courts, appellate courts in common law jurisdictions, as I expect most of you know, allow for separate opinion writing, including the production of dissents. But in most civil law courts and the European Court of Justice, it's different. They don't allow for the publication of minority opinions. They deliver judgments as single, unanimous opinions of the courts, which means only that the judges don't put their legal differences on display. It doesn't mean that they don't have any legal differences. And this system, the European system, has often sort of caused common lawyers a sense of perplexity, even dismay. Lord Neuberger in 2012 put it this way. He said, "One only has to look at some of the judgments of the European Court of Justice to see how compulsory unanimity can result in decisions which are, one, incomprehensible, two, have internally inconsistent reasoning, three, don't answer the issue which would refer to the court, or four, managed to exhibit all three regrettable characteristics." And yet, the picture is actually quite complicated, because common law appeal courts aren't above subscribing to this norm of unanimity. Until 1966, the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council was obliged to speak unanimously. And the Court of Criminal Appeals is, to this day, bound by statute to deliver single judgments, except in special circumstances. And there are other instances, both outside the common law courts and inside them, collective ministerial responsibility, for example, where it's not mandatory that decisions are made unanimously, but it's expected. And so the issue of unanimity in decision-making, though it might not be the preferred common law way of doing things, is actually something worth thinking about and taking seriously. And Professor Skouris is eminently suited, given his background on the European Court and as a university professor, he's eminently suited to exploring this, and he's been kind enough to visit us to do so and present the issues to us as he sees them this evening. Professor Skouris will speak for approximately 45 minutes, after which there'll be some time for questions. If you could put your phones on silent, that would be appreciated. We'll be doing the Twitter. There's a hashtag. And the event will be recorded. We'll make it available online as soon as we can. Professor Skouris, welcome to the RC.
So before I begin my presentation, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank the London School of Economics for the kind invitation to visit this prestigious institution. I consider it as a distinction to give a speech here, and I'm very grateful to Professor Nick Duxbury for chairing the event. This having been said, it seems inevitable for somebody like me, who served 17 years in a European institution, to express my deepest regrets for the apparently unstoppable and imminent Brexit. I'm saying that especially on behalf of the Court of Justice of the European Union, having in mind the immense contribution of our British colleagues to the jurisprudence of the Court, the always very well prepared requests from preliminary rulings stemming from UK courts, as well as the enlightening pleadings of UK barristers during the oral hearings before the court. It was always a pleasure to watch how barristers from this side of the channel were able to simplify very complicated issues without becoming simplistic. I'm absolutely sure that my former colleagues and their staff in Luxembourg will enormously miss the privilege of working together with distinguished common lawyers from the United Kingdom, a privilege that I could constantly appreciate during the 17 years of my judgeship and presidency. In reality, I am already in the core of my theme, because it is exactly this amazing synergy of common and civil lawyers and judges in the Luxembourg court that incites us to ask how the mechanism can function, notwithstanding the fact that its components are of a different nature and belong to different legal cultures. Concerning the question to what extent the personal view of judges and their specific contribution to the judgment of their court are visible, it is well known that there are different ways of deciding and announcing the outcome of legal disputes. First, there could be the so-called seriatim opinions. This is a collection of opinions from all judges without a position of the court as a whole. Second, there could be an opinion of a majority of judges, either signed or unsigned, along with any concurring or dissenting opinions. Finally, there could be a single unsigned opinion with no permitted dissent, a so-called per curiam opinion. Starting with the European Court of Justice, it is clear that the judgment of that court are published in a form that is typical for per curiam opinions. The judgment contains the composition of the court in the specific case. This is the grand chamber of 15 judges, the chamber of 5, or the chamber of 3 judges, by mentioning the president of the specific formation, the participating members, and the judge rapporteur, the reporting judge, without any other indication. This means that one can identify who has participated in the particular procedure, but not how the different members have voted. The decision expresses the will of the majority of the respective formation, even if the judgment, as I will try to explain later, should be regarded as a collective work of the members. To sum up, the information you receive is limited. The famous secret of deliberations does not permit the disclosure of whether the judgment was unanimous or if this was not the case, which judges formed the majority and the minority, and what were the reasons for the minority not to share the verdict of the majority. Concerning the secret of deliberations, it is worth mentioning that it constitutes a fundamental principle of the European judicial system. First, according to the Article 2 of the Statute of the Court of Justice of the European Union, the new members, as it happened earlier this week in Luxembourg, take an oath before the court during a formal and public sitting, which includes the obligation to preserve the secrecy of the deliberations. And second, this obligation does not have an expiration date, as it also applies to the retired members for the decision they have taken during their term at the court. In other words, the judgment of the Court of Justice constitutes an exact reproduction of the majority's opinion, whereas the arguments of an eventual minority are not in any way reproduced or communicated. It should be noted that the judge rapporteur, the reporting judge, who is always designated by the president of the court, maintains this role even if he belongs to the minority and is invited to prepare the draft judgment by adopting and putting forward the reasoning of the majority. I insist on this particularity because in some other legal orders, if the reporting judge joins the minority, he is then replaced, or at least formally assisted, by a member of the majority in order to present a better draft. In Luxembourg, the judge rapporteur preserves under all circumstances the function he is entrusted with and stays thus responsible for the final text of the judgment. By contrast to what happens before the European Court of Justice, judgments of UK courts are based on an individualistic approach. In a certain sense, they constitute the result of the individual opinions of the participating judges and are not easily accessible to many civil lawyers. For a civil lawyer, the structure of British judgments is unusual insofar as he is forced to study the different contributions of the court members which are presented in the first person. This is very characteristic of the British system, whereas in other legal orders that allow dissenting opinions in judgments of collegial courts, the personal contribution of the judges is still not totally visible. The participating judges are normally divided into two groups, forming respectively the majority and the minority of the court, and the reasoning for the majority and the minority is presented in a common, a global form, without entering into the details of the individual opinion of every judge. In other words, the ruling only offers information about the common approach of the minority and the majority and the minority in their entirety. Things become more complicated when the majority and or the minority are not able to share a common reasoning, which means that what is common to the majority and or the minority is only the solution of the case. And for the rest, they are composed of smaller groups with different concurring opinions. It is true that if the method of concurring opinions is taken to extremes, the difference with the UK system disappears, and the judgment with many concurring opinions takes gradually the form of a combination of individual positions. To draw a picture of the different options existing in the various European legal orders, we should take into account that most courts in the member states of the European Union are subject to a regime of almost total anonymity as far as the contributions of individual judges are concerned. Even the Supreme Courts of most of the member states of the European Union are obliged to respect the secrecy of deliberations and are thus not allowed to publish dissenting opinions. Referring in particular to the six founding member states of the European communities, this is France, Germany, Italy, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, it is from an historical point of view characteristic that all of them were and still are reluctant to the concept of dissenting opinions in the internal court system. The only noteworthy exception applies to many, but not all, constitutional courts of the member states of the European Union. It is remarkable that due to the special nature of those courts, only constitutional judges have progressively acquired the right to dissent and make their disagreement public. However, generally speaking, very few member states provide for the possibility of dissenting opinions to every court or tribunal. A striking example is Greece, where according to the Greek constitution, judges of all courts are entitled to publish their opinion under their name, and they often make use of this possibility. The Greek example is rather surprising insofar as Greek law has been mainly influenced by the German and French legal systems, which do not provide for dissenting opinion of judges, with the exception of the German Constitutional Court. Apart from Greece, it appears that in Bulgaria, Cyprus, Denmark, Finland, Poland, Portugal, Romania, Spain, and Sweden, constitutional as well as ordinary judges may publish separate opinions. Finally, the common law tradition is partially respected in Ireland. While ordinary judges have the right to dissent, this is excluded for judges of the Supreme Court in constitutional matters. Based on these examples, we can easily come to the conclusion that as regards dissenting opinions, there is perhaps a certain tendency, but not a clear distinction between common law and civil law countries. First of all, The publication of separate opinions constitutes the norm for constitutional courts of the member states of the European Union, including courts of civil law states such as the German Bundesverfassungsgericht. Second, in some common law countries, such as Malta, for example, dissents are totally forbidden, whereas in Ireland, dissenting opinions are for the most part admitted with the exception of constitutional disputes. Third, there are some civil law countries which allow not only constitutional but also ordinary judges to express and publish their individual opinion in every case. There is therefore a new trend that begins to become evident. Although dissenting opinions are more characteristic of common law systems, the right of judges to express and publish individual opinions becomes more and more popular also in civil law countries. Moving on now to international courts, and in particular to a comparison between the European Court of Human Rights and the European Court of Justice, dissenting opinions are allowed before the Strasbourg Court, whereas, as already mentioned, they do not exist in Luxembourg. In reality, the European Court of Human Rights follows the practice of international courts, where traditionally judges may issue individual opinions which are attached to the judgment of the majority, as it is the case of the International Court of Justice or of the International Criminal Court in Den Haag. Regarding the frequency of dissenting opinions before international courts, it is worth noting that judges make wide use of the right to publish individual opinions, and as far as the International Court of Justice is concerned, there is a significant trend among national and even more among ad hoc judges to dissent whenever the majority decides against their state. In this regard, the European Court of Justice is not a common international court, although it is composed, like the European Court of Human Rights, of one judge per member state. Contrary to what happens in international courts, in Luxembourg, there is no guarantee that the judge coming from the member state involved in the specific procedure will hear the case as a regular or ad hoc judge. Moreover, after the consecutive enlargements of the European Union, the probability that the national judge sits in cases involving the state of his origin is already statistically very small, and it is even smaller for the president and the vice president, who only sit in the Grand Chamber of the court. Having in mind that the Grand Chamber hears about 10% of the incoming cases before the court, about 60 to 70 cases per year regarding 28 member states, it is easy to calculate how exceptional it is that the president and or the vice president of the court participate in cases concerning their own state. After these more general remarks, it is time to focus on the advantages and disadvantages of the two systems, with special reference to the situation before the Court of Justice of the European Union. The arguments presented in favor of each option are numerous. They have a strong historical background and are more or less classic. To start with the main reasons invoked in favor of dissenting opinions, we should first refer to the need to ensure the independence of judges in the sense of their autonomy from the other members of the court. In a way, allowing the publication of dissenting opinions protects the internal side of the judge's independence. Second, by expressing dissenting opinions, judges maintain their intellectual integrity and enforce the legitimacy of courts in the eyes of the public, since the publication of dissents helps to strengthen public confidence in the judiciary, ensuring that court decisions are really taken by independent judges. Third, by presenting separately the different opinions, judgments reach higher levels of quality and clarity in the reasoning, insofar as majority and minority do not have to negotiate any compromise solutions, but are called to present their respective positions in a pure and conclusive form. Fourth, whenever judgments are delivered in the name of the people, dissenting opinions enhance the democratic legitimacy of the exercise of the judicial power, and at the same time, they render the whole process more transparent. Transparency and openness constitute major arguments justifying the introduction of dissenting opinions. Finally, dissenting opinions incite the courts to further develop the law. They build a forum of dialogue not only in the framework of the same court, but also between judges of higher and lower tribunals. To a certain extent, they may even pave the way for future decisions with a different approach to the same problem. Hence, separate opinions can be regarded as instruments of continuous debates between judges with positive effects to new developments in law. In my view, the supporters of dissenting opinions consider their position as modern and progressive compared to the more conservative approach of those who still oppose the right of judges to make their dissent public. In other words, if justice is regarded in general in a more traditional way, it would have primarily a stabilizing function, whereas regarded in a more dynamic way, it would be open to new developments and give adequate answers to current problems. Turning now to the opponents of dissenting opinions, most of them underline, in the first place, the need to protect the authority of judgments, which, once they become final, are binding and have to be enforced. Seen from this angle, the judicial activity aims to stabilize the legal system by producing binding decisions and by re-establishing social peace and legal certainty in specific disputes. Disclosing the existence of divergent opinions among the participating judges might undermine the authority of the decision and give to the losing party the opportunity to question the binding effect of the judgment and even to refuse to enforce it. In addition to that, there is a certain risk that some judges could present dissenting opinions even in relatively simple cases because they want either to gain publicity for themselves or to mark their disagreement with the majority not for juridical, but most probably for ideological or even for political reasons. Second, the absence of dissenting opinions ensures the clarity of judgments and preserves at the same time the collegiality among the judges who are sitting in the case. Judgments fulfill their scope not by opening a discussion about the possible solutions of a legal dispute, but by giving a unanimous and definitive solution to it. On the contrary, dissenting opinions may cause confusion as to the correct interpretation of law. One of the problems I personally have with separate and in particular with concurring opinions is how to dissociate obiter dicta from the ratio decidendi. In that respect, late Hale noted in a statement about judgments writing in the Supreme Court that in order not to detract from the power of the lead judgment, concurring opinions should concentrate on certain passages of this judgment and, I quote, hopefully only obiter dicta rather than the ratio decidendi. And she continues by admitting that, I quote again, technically, a simple concurrence is only agreeing with the outcome and the ratio and not with everything said along the way. The distinction between obiter dicta and ratio decidendi is already difficult without the presence of dissenting opinions, as long as judges sometimes insist on specific points in the reasoning, although they might not be absolutely necessary. Such points take the form of obiter dicta and should be normally avoided in per curiam judgments. The presence of concurring opinions in the framework of the majority makes this distinction even harder. Any discrepancies in the reasoning of the concurring opinions forming the majority raise the problem how to identify the essentials of the ratio decidendi. To give you a typical example of a decision stemming from the U.S. Supreme Court, I will cite a judgment of 1997 by using only the initials of the participating judges. I quote, K announced the judgment of the court and delivered the opinion of the court, except as to a portion of part A1. R, ST, and SO joined the opinion in full, and B joined except insofar as part A1 relied on an anti-competitive rationale. ST filed a concurring opinion. B filed an opinion concurring in part. OC filed a dissenting opinion in which S, C, T, and G joined. With all due respect, I don't even dare to imagine national judges of 28 member states of the European Union trying to discover or decipher in a similar case the ratio decidendi of the majority's opinion. The spirit of collegiality is, on the other hand, very important and necessary to ensure smooth cooperation within the court, whereas it could be argued that dissenting opinions, when they are frequently used, might create groups of judges in specific matters, as it seems to be the case again in the U.S. Supreme Court. It is often documented that the justices of the U.S. Court are divided into two groups, a more conservative one and a more liberal one. On this basis, the outcome of very important decisions, especially in human rights disputes or in highly contested social issues, can be predicted, given that through the recent nominations of justices, the conservative bloc seems to form actually the majority. In this regard, it is interesting to note that judges and commentators have often suggested to use the dissenting speech sparingly and that court members should apply self-restraint in that field. A good example is included in the canons of judicial ethics of 1924, which have been adopted by the American Bar Association on the basis of a draft prepared by a committee chaired by the then Chief Justice William Howard Taft. In the terms of Canon 19, I quote, it is of high importance that judges constituting a court of last resort should use effort and self-restraint to promote solidarity of conclusion and the consequent influence of judicial decision. And, I quote again, a judge should not yield to pride of opinion or value more highly his individual reputation than that of the court to which he should be loyal. Furthermore, Chief Justice John Roberts, in his 2005 confirmation hearings before the Senate of the United States, expressed the hope for greater unanimity among the justices of the Supreme Court, announced his willingness to bring about more consensus, and considered as one of his top priorities to reduce the number of dissenting opinions. The statistics do not confirm a notable change in the habits of the U.S. Supreme Court. On the contrary, it is significant to note that during the period after the Second World War, the rate of cases with dissenting opinions is almost constantly over 50%. The next point concerns, curiously, the independence of judges, and hereby the same principle which has been previously invoked in order to justify dissenting opinions. Here, the external side of the judge's independence is at stake. This is the independence from pressures coming from outside. As long as the position of all judges remains secret, it is easier for them to take their decision based on their own conviction and without any interference from external sources. Even if this argument is not very flattering for judges, as it suggests that they need to be protected against external influence, it reveals the ambiguity of the question of dissenting opinions. The same value the independence of judges serves as argument in favor as well as against the right of judges to make their personal opinion public. It is not my intention to discuss all these arguments and draw a conclusion by expressing a preference for or against dissenting opinions in general. I firmly believe that it is by far not recommendable to try to give a unique answer to a complicated question, in particular if the opposite systems have a strong tradition and apparently function without major problems in the different legal orders. What I'm willing to do in the second part of my lecture is to present some elements which should be taken into consideration if one wishes to explain the reasons for the introduction or rejection of separate opinions of judges. It is, of course, not a coincidence that all these points have a special connection to the regime applicable in the Court of Justice of the European Union. My first point concerns the number of judges participating and voting in the specific procedure. To take as examples the U.S. Supreme Court, the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom, or even the majority of constitutional courts, the number of the deciding judges is relatively limited. This is from 5 to 9. Under these circumstances, the judgment, even if they are not unanimous, are accessible to the interested reader as long as the majority and the minority do their best to adopt a concise, a uniform reasoning allowing the reader to distinguish them clearly. Things become more complicated when courts take decisions with a substantially bigger number of judges. The plenary of the Greek Council of State is normally composed of 25, and the Grand Chamber of the Court of Justice of 15 judges. Of such figures, the difficulties to render comprehensive decisions become more important because it is not at all excluded that there might exist a majority and a minority of members, each with 2 or even more concurring opinions. Let's now imagine such a judgment and think how problematic it can be to implement it by deducting the authoritative interpretation of law given by the court. I can assure you that some 90 pages long judgment of the Council of State of my home country have exactly this structure, and when they arrived as preliminary rulings in Luxembourg, my colleagues and myself had serious difficulties to identify the real problem of the cases and give an appropriate answer from the point of view of European law. Of course, nothing is impossible, and we see that with the dissenting and concurring opinions of the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights, which comprises 17 judges. Nevertheless, I want to stress the need to keep judgment comprehensive, and for that reason I strongly believe that we should be reluctant to introduce dissenting opinions before judicial panels with a high number of members. Next, I would like to focus on the transparency argument. Is there really a necessity to be informed if there was a disagreement within the court and who exactly expressed a dissenting opinion? While it is, I think, easy to accept that the publication of separate opinions enhances the transparency in general, one should not neglect the fact that this view is not common to many important legal orders. In fact, we could even say that the global use of dissenting opinions before every court and tribunal is still an exception among the member states of the European Union. Especially for the European Court of Justice, the requirement of clarity of judgments rendered on the basis of requests for preliminary rulings by national judges is stronger than the need for transparency. The judges in the member states wish to be duly informed of the correct interpretation of the European Union law and look for an unambiguous answer from the Court of Justice. Having in mind that more than 2/3 of the incoming cases before the Court of Justice are preliminary rulings, preliminary references, the success of this unique form of dialogue between national and European judges becomes obvious and is based on 2 elements. The Court of Justice gives apparently satisfactory and well-founded answers without delaying the procedure before the National Court. It is more than doubtful that the preliminary rulings would be equally successful if the judgments of the Court of Justice contained dissenting or concurring opinions. The Court is asked to develop the right interpretation of European law in order for that law to be applied not only to the pending case before the National Court, but to all similar cases and by all courts of the Member States. What is needed is clarity and precision. Please imagine for one moment all these national judges who, without being neither specialized in European law nor acquainted to deal with separate opinions, been confronted with judgments of the Court of Justice containing several and divergent answers to questions on the interpretation of European law. As long as the main task of the Court of Justice, together with the principal scope of the preliminary ruling procedure, are to guarantee the uniform interpretation and application of European law, there is little space for experiments with dissenting opinions. That minority opinions are not published in Luxembourg does not mean that they don't occur and says nothing about the way they are usually treated. Without revealing any secrets, because I'm also bound by the secrecy of deliberations, I have to admit that different approaches may arise, especially in cases before the Grand Chamber of the Court, whose mission is to deal with the more important cases. Having chaired the Grand Chamber for 12 years, I can confirm that we had disagreements among us, but I have sincere doubts if all of them would have led to dissenting opinions. On the contrary, I believe that only in a few cases the members of the minority would have presented real dissenting opinions. Quite often, the disagreeing members recognize that the other side, the majority, has also strong arguments. One of the popular expressions in Luxembourg was, "I am not quite happy with the result, but I can live with it." Second, the non-disclosure of dissenting opinion encourages all judges, and in particular the members of the minority, not to stay silent by refusing any cooperation with the majority, but on the contrary, to continue to participate actively in the deliberation in order to influence the reasoning and render the final judgment more widely acceptable. As far as the majority is concerned, its members have a real interest to invite the minority to further cooperate with them by making an effort to deal with the reasons that led the minority to not share the view of the majority. In that way, the reasoning of the judgment can be strengthened. Of course, that is not always the case, as you mentioned before. Sometimes, incorporating the concerns of the minority in the decision might lead to a reasoning that is too short or too vague to be convincing. Academics have frequently criticized that fact. As one of the remedies for the lack of clarity, it is proposed to read the judgment together with the always published opinion of the Advocate General of the Court, who expresses his or her personal point of view by proposing a full and coherent solution of the case. It is for that reason not surprising that some scholars claim that the opinions of the Advocate General alleviate the consequences of the absence of dissenting opinions. Third, and most important, judgments of the Grand Chamber of the Court constitute real collective works of the participating members, as the deliberations take a long time and are rich in ideas. It is not exaggerated to state that the final outcome of the case is normally shared, if not by all members with the same enthusiasm, then at least by a grand majority of them, so that the chamber can concentrate on the reasoning. In order to prepare the discussion, and based on the draft of the reporting judge, the other members usually present written notes proposing either another solution for the case or a different wording of specific parts of the reasoning. On the ground of these notes, an exchange of views takes place, under the guidance of the president of the court and with the active participation of the judge and rapporteur. One of the main criteria for the discussion is to improve the reasoning in order to allow national judges as well as other European and national institutions to implement the judgment. In this regard, even potential difficulties in the translation of certain points into the different official languages of the court come into play. I remember very well my former colleague Sir David Edward reminding us many times during the deliberation to give attention to translation problems and asking to prefer a wording suitable to be understood by common law judges. The spirit of collegiality does not appear only when deliberations go on. There are additional mechanisms to reach common decisions of the court members. This happens mainly when all members of the court, judges and advocate general, meet every week in order to distribute the cases to a specific formation of the court, Grand Chamber 15, Chamber of 5, or Chamber of 3 judges, and to decide whether further instruction is needed, an opinion of the Advocate General is appropriate, or a hearing should take place. To all these questions, the judge rapporteur presents his or her proposals in a preliminary report. On the basis of this report, a discussion takes place among the members, sometimes with different approaches, and gives to everybody the chance not only to be informed on all incoming cases, but also to co-determine to a certain extent the decision-making process. Finally, we must not forget that with the consecutive enlargements of the European Union, especially the accession of the United Kingdom, the home of Seriatim judgments, but also Ireland and Denmark in 1973, the issue of dissenting opinions in the European Court of Justice was raised and discussed several times, and most importantly, in the negotiations for the preparation of the Treaty of Maastricht. At the Intergovernmental Conference of 1992, the European Parliament proposed the practice of dissenting opinions to be introduced to the judicial system of the European communities. However, every single time, a decision was taken against introducing dissenting opinions. In the long discussion on the virtues and deficiencies of dissenting opinions, one point is, my view, particularly remarkable. Whenever academics comment on the European Court of Justice regime, they normally end up by asking to change the status quo and permit dissenting opinions, mainly in order to improve the transparency of deliberations and enhance the independence of judges. On the contrary, I'm not aware of statements suggesting to those who generally support dissenting and concurring opinions to change their minds and abolish the right of judges to publish their disagreement with the majority's position. One could think that such a behavior of the supporters of dissenting opinions is partial and not absolutely fair to the other side. In any case, the opponents of dissenting opinions take notice of the other option without recommending to abrogate the right of court's minorities to express themselves in public. Ladies and gentlemen, with regard to the European Court of Justice, I would like to point out in my conclusion that our intention was, and I'm sure continues to be, to consent and not to dissent, in order to guarantee the uniform interpretation and application of the European Union law, we need judgments shared by a grand majority of members. We need judgment containing the best possible reasoning, and we need judgments permitting to convince national judges and all the other stakeholders, European institutions, lawyers and academics, to follow the decision of the Court of Justice. By communicating any eventual disagreements in public, this goal would become particularly difficult. Thank you very much for your attention.
Well, we've got around about 35 minutes or so to ask, to have questions and answers. So if you want to put your hands up, we've got a roving microphone. And
thank you.
Yes, feel free. Well, while you're thinking up your... Oh, sorry, we've got one question here.
Do you think the publication of dissenting judgments might make national courts more or less willing to accept the reasoning of the ECJ depending on the nationality of the dissenting judges? Like, I don't know, if a German judge on the ECJ dissented, then it might affect Germany in particular.
How do you think that could... That would be possible?
I'm just thinking of, I don't know, the political dynamics of if it's known that a judge in a particular case from a particular country had dissented maybe very strongly, whether that might have an impact on the national politics or the national legal reception of the ECJ judgment.
I mean, it happens, of course, that judgments of national courts arriving as preliminary references to the Court of Justice contain majority and minority dissenting and concurring opinions. But all of them want to, and it happens also, and it is also interesting, this particular point, it happens also that some courts of member states follow a specific practice according to which if there is a dissenting opinion in the framework of the national court, then they have to ask the Court of Justice. But I think even they expect the Court of Justice to give a clear answer without many possibilities. I mean, you should also note in this field that what is, I'm talking about this preliminary rulings procedure. What is, the court is asked to give the right interpretation of law. So it's not the outcome of a case as it happens before normal courts. They have, I mean, a dispute and they must give a solution to that. The court does not give a solution to the case. The court is asked to give the authoritative interpretation of European Union law. And for the time being, I think it is better to do it in a unique answer and not with many, let's say, differences and disagreements.
Just looking around, I saw some more questions. There's a question right at the back. I'm going to keep you on hold for a little bit and then I'll come back so that let's get some questions down here. So there's some people over here, just at the end of the 1, 2, 3, 4 rows up. Maybe take that cluster of people there. Yes.
Hi. So regarding this, this difference between common law and civil law. So I was wondering. So my question is twofold. So first of all, I was wondering when doing this analysis of like this comparative analysis between common law and civil law, would it be appropriate to say that the premise of adjudication and the purpose of adjudication in these different systems can be assumed to be the same, and if yes, what they will be? And my question following that is, so one of the points being raised was dissenting opinion may cause confusion over the correct interpretation of the law. So I was just wondering, when we talk about the correct interpretation of the law, given interpretation implies a sense of argumentative advantage, and what we mean by a correct interpretation is possibly referring to what we call as the majority judgments, doesn't that gives rise to the reasonable possibility that there's nothing such as an absolute correct answer in the first place. So, and that sort of suggests why dissenting opinions are necessary. Thank you.
I mean, every human product is in reality incomplete. So you can never have the correct interpretation of law or the correct interpretation of a specific disposition for all time. This is perhaps true. But, I mean, the main question is, for me, what is the main task of the court, or of courts in general? to give an answer, to give a solution, to make a judgment. In reality, you should not forget that courts have to decide upon disputes. So there is a dispute. And if you come now, I mean, from a civil, from the point of a civil lawyer, and say, yes, there is a solution, I mean, for, in favor of the claimant, let's say, but it could be also against the claimant, majority, minority. And the idea that in future times, the minority could obtain the majority, is this really a good idea to explain and to introduce the possibility for the minority to express its point of view? I can understand that it can be very interesting for academics, for instance, and I regret that not to know what happens before the Court of Justice. This I can also understand, but I don't think that it should be enough a reason, I mean, a sufficient reason in order to introduce a system which is with what, with, I mean, this is not familiar to the Court of Justice anyway.
The person next to the person who just asked the question, let's take these people.
Hi there. So just a quick follow-up. Given the very existence of common law and civil law system implies two distinct views of legal theories, that let's say the common law system probably values more interpretation and civil law systems values more direct, like explicit directions in terms of like how we bind individuals to follow certain decisions. Given that, on that particular premise, wouldn't it be more honest for a judicial community to admit that there are differences in terms of interpretations between judges so as to allow and tie the larger community and the society to decide and to regulate how judges should interpret laws and decide laws? Wouldn't that give courts a greater democratic credential?
So, I mean, I would like perhaps to ask you, are courts democratic institutions? Do they have to make judgments on the presumption of the majority in society? They have, and that can be also a very important task of courts, to protect minorities against majorities. Law is there for everybody. And one of the main values we accept is that majorities must also respect what minorities wish and want to do. So if you say that judges should perhaps act or react according to the presumed willing of the majority, if a law is then decided by the parliament, the democratic legitimacy is clear. So can you examine this law perhaps as far as constitutional issues are concerned? I'm not sure that the democratic element should now be introduced in this discussion between majority and minority, dissenting opinions and separate opinions, to allow them or not to allow them.
And just one, was somebody else off there wants to, we'll clear that part of the room and then we'll, yeah, go ahead.
Hello, so I'm actually from America. And so in America in 1977, there was a Supreme Court case called Marx versus the United States, which basically created the precedent that whenever you had a fragmented court which couldn't decide on a single rationale to explain its decisions, then the, I'm just going to read from the decision, then the holding of the court may be viewed as that position taken by those members who concurred in the judgment on the narrowest grounds. So with that in mind, were the ECJ to adopt a system whereby judges were given the ability to dissent, then would you urge for something along the lines of the Marx rule to also be adopted?
I'm not sure I've understood what was now the question. Can you please repeat it?
Yeah, so the Marx rule within the U.S. Supreme Court says that whenever you have a fragmented court which cannot decide on a single rationale to explain its decision, then the case will be decided on the narrowest ground of concurrence. And so, were the ECJ to adopt a system whereby you had minority judges who were ability to voice their dissent, would you adopt or would you urge for the adoption of something along the lines of the Marx rule?
I don't think that would be a good solution, because we need also, of course, not only a decision of the case or an answer to the question put by the National Court, that we need also that decision to be founded on good and convincing arguments. So if you take now what is the lowest common denominator, the lowest common denominator, of course, this is not convincing, and this is not, what courts should do. At the end, this is the majority which decides in all systems. So if you want now to have always a common approach, this is not possible. We do, in the Court of Justice, everybody does everything in order to have a common approach. But this is not possible in any case. And it should not be done, let's say, by risking not to have a good reasoning of the case. Because judges, national judges, need also to be convinced that the outcome of the court is the right interpretation of, I don't want to use correct, because, let's say, the right and binding interpretation. And you know, at the end, what is important is to have a solution of a dispute, and not a dispute which is eternal.
Now, Floris, did you want to ask a question? Do you need the microphone? I think you probably do. Yeah,
here we go. I can try with that.
It's more for the people at the back, so they can hear you.
Thank you, Professor, for his very elegant and eloquent presentation. I am one of the professors, associate professor in EU law here, and I've in the past definitely criticized the Court of Justice for its judgment, so I would like to apologize first. What I found most interesting in your presentation was not so much the sort of pros and cons of these two approaches, but really that the EU legal order is something specific, that there are certain considerations specific to the EU legal order that make it such that one of the two should be preferred. And I would like you to elaborate a bit on that, because I think that's really the interesting part. One example might be that someone raised earlier that, there's no EU police or EU army that will enforce the rules of the EU on citizens everywhere. So we rely so much on national courts doing that, that actually having a unitary opinion rather than dissenting opinion strengthens the authority of the law as such, regardless of the outcome. Or in preliminary references that it's the national judges that have to apply the ruling of the Court of Justice on the facts. And giving them dissenting opinions actually might make it easier for them to map out the facts on the ruling that they would like to have rather than the majority ruling. So are there any other sort of considerations or particularities of the EU legal order that would argue in favor of this approach without dissenting opinions? Because I'm actually one in favor of that. I completely agree with your position that this actually meets the requirements of the EU legal order much better than a process of dissenting opinions.
I will try to give a simple answer. If you are asked to give the right authoritative, qualify it as you like, but the interpretation of a specific rule of European law, what are the elements that make decisions with dissenting opinions better than decisions without dissenting opinions? That should be established in order to have this, I mean, a new development in European Union law concerning the European Court of Justice. And as far as I see, there are no arguments in favor of that are so convincing and would justify to change the system. I think this is perhaps a belief, or I don't want to say a dream, that would enhance the authoritative power of the judgment. If, I mean, you see that there were 10 among 15 for this solution and 5 were against. What is the advantage of that for the national judge? Not to mention what would happen if you have dissenting and concurring opinions, and then the national judge who is looking to find the reasons for the judgment. Look at judgments, I mean, I don't want to disqualify them, but sometimes it is very difficult to understand what is the reasoning in this case. Of course, if you take a decision on the ground, dissenting opinions are easier because you know who won and who lost. But if you have to give an answer in a legal on a legal question, I think who won and who lost, can you really understand that? Can you bring that in the case?
No, there was... Do you still want to ask a question now? I feel bad, but I'm going to send you to the talk. This gentleman here with his hand up, he's been waiting a while.
Could come a little bit. Could come.
He could have done that. I feel bad doing that.
Sorry. To a certain extent, it's already been answered by the previous question, but I was wondering, because you were going on about how the practical context in which you have... for the kind of adoption of dissenting opinions is important, such as the number of judges, such as the context and the need for clarity and transparency. So do you think it would be possible to trade off practicality and justice if you kind of accept the kind of very debatable premise that dissenting opinions add to justice?
I don't want to comment on what happens in other legal orders, because I think it is well done. Everybody has his tradition, and it is very well known that in this country tradition is a very important element. But the question is, why should this system be introduced in another order or in another regime? So, and I would say, perhaps continuing the argument I used at the end of my lecture, it is really interesting that those who love dissenting opinions want that system to be established also to those who do not love dissenting opinions. And this is for me also interesting to note that this is not vice versa. So why is it necessary to have it? If you take states, countries like France, Italy, Germany, they have also very good courts, and they have also very good Supreme Courts. Those courts are not allowed to publish any dissenting opinions. But, I mean, I don't think that the French legal system or the German legal system or the Italian legal system are not good. If they can live with the system, let them live with this system.
Is that your sense, by the way, that there's a sort of feeling outside civil law countries that there's a wish to impose plurality opinions, seriatim opinion writing on the civil law tradition? I mean, I've never picked up on that sense. I mean, I think there's sort of bewilderment sometimes on the part of common lawyers that there is this commitment, but it's not something that I think people...
In the discussion among scholars, this is in my eyes obvious, that those who are acquainted to dissenting opinions want that system to be introduced also in other legal systems, whereas the let's say, those who don't have dissenting opinions don't ask the countries with dissenting opinions to change their system.
I must say I've never seen that, but that's... There was a question, there was a couple of questions here, so let's take this gentleman first, just behind you, the grey jacket. Yeah.
Yeah, as a common lawyer, it seems to me very obvious that where national systems are concerned, dissenting judgments are much better than the other, than the civil law system, because it's so easy, or much easier, for bad politicians to hijack the judiciary. But the situation in the European community is completely different, because as you said, it doesn't have an army or a police force to impose tyranny. And of course, we've had this ridiculous argument, in my opinion, in this country, that the European Court is part of a tyrannical imposition upon Britain. It's wrong.
I don't know.
I don't know.
No dissent. Yes.
There's no dissent on that. No, I mean, and I don't feel really like a tyrant. I never felt like a tyrant. Thank you.
Switch the radar back on. There's a lady here who...
So you mentioned the Advocate General's opinions, and I'm just wondering, because I think they were written before the judgment. Can you hear me?
Does that work?
Okay. I think the Advocate General's opinion is written before the judgment, so I was just wondering, what do you think the influence of the AG opinion is on the deliberations of the judges? And also, in some cases, the judges don't agree with the opinion. What do you think the effect of that is on uniform application?
I think that it is very important that the Court of Justice has the possibility to have a full and concise opinion of the Advocate General. I mean, he has an advantage. The advantage is he gives his individual opinion according to his convictions. And in some cases, there is no doubt that the opinions of the Advocate General are, if you want to qualify it, is that more coherent than a judgment can be. The importance of the opinion of the Advocate General is a big one. It's because even if you disagree, this is the same discussion which takes place in countries with dissenting opinions. Judges are not enemies, even if they belong to different sides. So it is, a stimulating element to have an opinion of an Advocate General, even if you disagree with this opinion. No, I don't want to give statistical elements, because normally, the outcome of the case is conform with the opinion of the Advocate General. But, of course, it is true that the opinions of the Advocate General can add value to the judgment because they can explain in a simpler way, as it is for a court, for a collegial court, that how the case should be decided. So it is important to have the opinions of the Advocate General, and this is, I think, also a positive element. The opinions do not replace dissenting opinions, it's clear. The opinions of the Advocate General. But they are part of the whole, they are the part of the whole system. And if you take the judgment and the opinion of the Advocate General, sometimes you can also better understand the problem and the solution. This is true.
There's somebody here. Just can you see the hand up? Just on the right there.
Hi. So how important do you think it it factors in that the European Union is a relatively large court, because like the U.S., it is, like you mentioned, it's a much smaller court, and I think it does sort of force judges to flesh out their thought process a lot more, and over time be adhere to the views that they're putting forth. And if they later on disagree, they have to account for it. Like you said, I mean, I think it just brings more clarification. I think it allows for more principles of legal theories to be fleshed out. So how much do you think it factors in that a larger court would create more disarray?
It's a simple question of a number. If you have five judges or seven judges or nine judges, you'll have less dissenting opinions than if you have, or compared to the case, you have 15 judges or 17 or 19. It's very simple in my eyes. But, I mean, sometimes I have, although I was always a professor, so I consider myself also as a professor, but I don't think judgments are the right place to make a legal theory. I know that in some cases also judges would love to make legal theory in the judgment, but this is not the right place. Judgments are there to solve problems, not to add problems, and not to make legal theory. This is my firm conviction. So I can understand that you also students and scholars would like to have judgments of courts as in order to add or to make a discussion richer, but this is not the main task of the judiciary.
We have a question here.
A bit earlier, there seemed to be some consensus here that nobody was...
Could you please speak?
A bit earlier, there seemed to be some consensus in the room that no one was at all critical of the reach of the European Court of Justice, but many of us might consider that the way in which it always, always made judgments favourable to integration is a very biased way of dealing with what should be legal issues. And that's one reason why British people want to leave the European Union.
This might be the case, but the only comment I can make is a court with the mission to interpret, and as it is written in the treaties, European law, and make European law be in a certain sense good for application. It should be applied. Do you imagine that such a court of this with this mission could do anything else than the court has done in the previous years?
Yes, but it's become a bit like the Court of Star Chamber, which Maitland criticised as being a court not of justice, but of a court applying a policy.
I don't see this. I mean, I can only say, perhaps, what a British judge said after the end of his term. He was invited by the House of Lords in order to be informed, for the House of Lords to be informed on the Court of Justice and how the job is done and so on. And there was a question: can you tell us what was your agenda at the court? This is a political question, of course. And his answer was, you know, at the court, he was 15 years at the court, I was judge rapporteur in about 500 cases, and I participated in other 1,000 or 1,500 cases as judge. I didn't have the time to have an agenda.
This one could run and run, so
Which judge was that?
David Edward.
Huh. Niamh, could you... equidistant, so I don't know who wants to...
Thank you for a really, really interesting, really interesting presentation. I suppose I work in EU law and would have a common law background, and I suppose the thing that maybe strikes me sometimes when I read Court of Justice judgments is something that you picked up a little bit on in the speech, which is the problem of potential vagueness. And whether, I think common lawyers reading Court of Justice judgments sometimes are a little bit frustrated by the somewhat Delphic quality sometimes of at least the disposition of the case. And I'm thinking in particular of I work in competition law, and we do a very heavily awaited judgment, the Intel judgment last year, where you've got a really trenchant general court judgment, you've got an equally trenchant but entirely opposite advocate general judgment, and then we're waiting for what the Grand Chamber says, and they seem to try to square the circle. So they say both the general court and the advocate general are somehow right, and they send it back to the commission to get, or the general court to think again about it. And I was wondering whether, I suppose, is opaqueness a kind of a necessary trade-off in the EU system? Is it, you might entirely disagree, is it a problem? You might disagree that there is some opaqueness in the judgment, but I just wondered whether you thought it is an issue that maybe, not a lack of clarity, but sometimes a lack of maybe precision in what exactly we're saying and why.
I would say that sometimes it is not possible to have a clearer answer to questions which have not been solved by the legislator. You know, a court cannot repair all deficiencies of European law. Because if the court does it, then there is also the criticism that this court is very a factor in the political process and plays a political role. So it happens, of course, that I would accept it, that some judgments have a certain lack of clarity. But it is not the question of dissenting opinions or majority and minority opinions. I'm not sure that a dissenting opinion would be, in that case, clearer than the majority opinion. You should always take into consideration that European law is not perfect. This is also the outcome of compromises between the European Parliament, the Council, the Commission. You know, this is this famous trilogue, as they say, which is, I mean, impossible as idea, because it's only if you take Greek as the source of this, is dialogue. Dialogue exists, but not a trilogue. So it's, but anyway, so sometimes it happens that things are imperfect, and if they are imperfect, the court cannot always make them perfect.
I think
so. That will, I think, with any system, criticism would stay, would exist, and it is also healthy that criticism exists.
I had a question, but we've only got about 5 minutes. Make sure I get yours in first. So there's somebody here. Just keep your hand up and. Yeah.
Would you say that the question, like the question of having an advocate general or allowing for dissenting opinions, is an either or?
Is it an either or choice between having dissenting opinions and having complete unanimity? Isn't there something?
It's in between.
The question you asked before about.
Can you have both, basically, or do you choose one for a legal system or for court?
I mean, the The clear separation is between one judgment without any dissenting opinions or other opinions, or judgments with dissenting opinions. If you have dissenting opinions, then there are, of course, differences between the different systems which adopt dissenting opinions, but in the practice, as I tried to say before, there is, a judgment with dissenting opinion, majority-minority, with the same approach. And then you can have concurring opinions. That is, you have a majority with concerning the result, the outcome, and the minority. But then, in the framework of the majority, you have different reasonings. It may occur. And this is, of course, something which would be totally unacceptable for the time being before the Court of Justice. So I don't know if I gave an answer to your question, but there's nothing in between. It's either you accept or you don't accept. No, if you accept, then you have, in my eyes, to accept also concurrent opinions.
It was more that I'm not aware of a system having both an advocate general and...
An advocate general?
Yes, opinions.
No. This is, of course, but... excuse me, I didn't... I haven't... No. Advocate General, this is a particularity before the European Court of Justice. It exists in the framework of the French Council of State. That was something which had been introduced in the beginning because French law was very, of course, strong in the beginning during the foundation of the European communities. And this institution has been... taken by from the French legal system. There was always the habit that before the deliberation of the court, a member of this court takes the word and presents a solution of the case. And on the basis of this report, of this solution, of this proposal, and of the on the basis of the discussion among the members, then the decision is taken.
We have one question here. We can just about fit it in, I think.
For sure. Sorry, just a practical question that I may have missed. Given that there's a non-disclosure of dissenting opinions, are they at least published or given within the judicial committee or the judicial society to develop future reasoning? Are they documented anywhere?
No.
At all? Not at all. Okay.
No.
And is there a reason for that?
The secret of deliberations is sacred in Luxembourg. So you never get an information on that, even not after 50 years.
Seeing as the answer to that question was really quick, I just want to take the liberty of asking one last question, which there is a principle of transparency built into the treaty. So I know the principle of transparency only applies to administrative acts of courts, not actual decisions. But why exempt decision making? If you believe in transparency, then why exempt?
I could say ask the member states. They are the fathers of the treaty. Okay. Why they have expressly provided for that transparency is not applicable. Okay. For the Court of Justice, concerning the judgment.
Sure. Well,
they should know something. I think they had something in mind.
You certainly be transparent with us. See what I did there? And so I thought that was really good. Not just...
I would say I strongly support this view of the member states.
Okay.
To be transparent.
Well, thank you all for coming.